You have entered the realm of critical analysis, critical strangeness, critical mass, and cretinous humor. Fasten your convictions, they're in for a bumpy ride.
Welcome to the Polyschismatic Reprobate Tower. Here with a face for radio and a voice for silent films, I'm Dan the Demented, and opposite me is my lovely, adorable, and devastatingly intelligent co-host, Deviant Deb. On this show, we advocate unspeakable obscenity, such as freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, open communication, and personal responsibility. If critical analysis of the issues that you hold dear offends you, don't firebomb us, don't boycott our network, don't call in Islamic extremists to assassinate us, and don't pray for us, just switch to another podcast. Today we'll show you what happens when a pair of hapless reprobates find themselves trapped in a dungeon with a ravenous molecular biologist.
Zach Moore is a PhD in molecular biology and works as a biomedical researcher. He hosts Evolution 101 at Free Thought Media, a series of 10 to 20-minute lectures on the basis of evolutionary and molecular biology and the common misconceptions that people bring to the table when studying these subjects.
We interviewed Zach earlier this week and got our neurons properly fried by it, and so we decided to pass the experience on along to you.
I'm not an expert by any means. I'm not an evolutionary biologist. I'm not a professor. I do have a PhD in pathobiology and molecular medicine, so I am a trained scientist, but most of what I do is biomedical research. So I'm not an educator like Dr. Pigliucci or some of the other guys that are like Ken Miller, who are just really absolutely great at it. And incidentally, I would recommend, even though Ken Miller is a Catholic, I would recommend his book, Finding Darwin's God.
Oh, wonderful book.
So I did the first show that Reggie actually hosted. It was just basically me answering questions that people had posted in the chat room and were calling in to ask and stuff like that. And then the week after, Dr. Pigliucci did a show. And after that, it was even too much for Reggie to handle, and so he just sort of dropped it. He's a pretty ambitious guy, but it got a little bit too much for him, which is, no problem. It really sort of started me thinking about, wouldn't this be sort of like a fun thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
And when he sort of put the call out there and said, well, I don't really have the resources to do this anymore. Is there anybody else interested? And I never really thought about taking it over, but I was, still thinking that the most I could do is maybe put together a podcast, like once a week. And so it was just kind of like an experiment. At first, I was just like, well, because, I know podcasting has been around for a while and blogging too. I'm certainly not on the leading edge of the curve, but I figured, well, why not? And so I did one episode and then I did another episode. And it's kind of fun for me to get that experience with, putting these concepts together and it's in sort of an, it's like a little 10-minute lecture, if you will, so it's it's kind of fun for me to have that experience, and I learn from it too because I certainly don't know everything, and so there's a lot of stuff that I have to look up and prepare because every time I answer a question, I'm also sort of answering it for myself, because there's lots of things that I don't know about evolution, and it's just really fun to look it up and find out what's out there and look at the evidence. And really the main thing that I bring to the table is my scientific training and my sort of understanding of the language and the ability to sort of make it understandable, make it palatable to people who don't really know what a genome is per se.
Right. Which is a really powerful thing. Any discipline has its own language. People looking out, looking in from the outside come, they read the selfish gene and they're like, the picture they come away with is often not what was written because they don't speak the jargon.
Right. I think there's only so much you can do because when you think about it, like the last one that I did was transposons. That is a tough thing to visualize.
It's an archaic subject. Oh yeah.
I mean it's really, you're it's hard enough for most people to understand DNA and how it works. And that's why I first conceived of doing the molecular evidence revolution, which is my absolute favorite subject. Obviously, my training's in molecular biology. So Doug Theobald from Talk Origins has done a really great job of putting all that stuff together. And I actually did contact him before I started doing the show to see if he could get any involvement, because I was really just enamored of the way he put all the evidence together.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he is a postdoc currently, and he's jockeying for a faculty position, so he's probably even busier than I am at work. So so he had to decline, but I am using his resource pretty heavily for that. And so that's was really the main thrust of my message, I guess. It would be the shows I'm doing now, the series on the molecular evidence revolution, because mm-hmm. I think it's so strong. I mean, when you look at it, and what's really cool is that you really don't have to take my word for it. All these sequences, I mean, the human genome, the chimpanzee genome, and more genomes are being added all the time, are available on the internet, and you can
really
download. Oh yeah,
you got a link for us where we can go and look at the text of them.
Yeah, it's ncbi.nlm.nih.gov. The National Center for Biotechnology Information, basically. It's run by the United States government. And it's basically a clearinghouse for genetic information. They've got nucleotide sequences. They've got protein sequences. They've got the entire genome that you can sort of browse through, like you're browsing through a library.
Wow,
almost.
Very nice.
And you can search for specific sequences and match them up. Mm-hmm. You can take any gene, and one of the previous podcasts I've even offered, and I've done this a number of times in sort of, I've had some correspondence with different creationists in the past and trying to explain these things, and I've just sort of said, you know, point blank to them, give me any gene and I will go look it up. I will find the human sequence, I will find the chimpanzee sequence, I will find any other sequence from any other animal that's published, and we can sit down and look at them base pair by base pair, and you can see how they've changed over time. It's, you know, any gene out there, any gene.
Watson and Crick were what, 60 years ago now?
Yeah, about 60 years ago, that's right.
60 years later, after the discovery of DNA, any teenager with a Linux box and a grep command can compare genomic sequences. That's incredible.
Well, you don't even have to get you can use Windows even.
That's true.
you can download it to a floppy disk. I mean, you can download
Is that small?
I thought
it was something like
not a floppy, maybe not an old school floppy disk.
It was about two, isn't it?
But a zip disk.
Really? It'll fit in 100 megabytes?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd been under the impression that it was quite a bit longer than that.
Well, see, you can download them in contigs, and each contig is less than a megabyte, I know.
Wow.
And
a contig is about the size of a gene, or how does that
work? A contig is just basically a big chunk of DNA. They split up these chromosomes into, because it's kind of a lot to work with for, not necessarily, because they're not, like I said, each one is just basically less than a megabyte, so it's not a big file.
Okay.
As we think of, like, now, big files are like, you know, gigabytes.
Right.
But with the type of algorithms that these things get placed in, because
because there's only four characters, you can do a hell of a compression algorithm on them.
Exactly. And so, so there's a lot of computation that goes into these analyses, so it is quite a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be comparing and running phylogenetic analysis and stuff like that, and trying to construct a cladogram. So it is a lot of work to do. But it's just that basically they break down the chromosomal sequence into large sections called contigs. And the contig is made by the way they sequence genomes now is actually, it's pretty cool. They used to do it really slow. They would go through and almost like going from point A to point B, you know, just sort of linearly. And there's this guy named Craig Venter who started a company named Celera. And actually he started a group called TIGER, the Institute for Genomic Research. Yeah, and he's sort of considered now the guy who sequenced the human genome, because the technique that he came up with was so revolutionary. And it really changed the way that sequencing happened. And he came up with something called shotgun sequencing, which is basically, instead of going from point A to point B, you take that whole linear stretch of DNA and you just, you know, blast the hell out of it, and you throw down random primers and you sequence in all sorts of weird places. And so it's sort of like you take a shotgun blast and you just blast the whole thing, and you get little tiny bits of sequence from all over the entire length of the genome. And then you take those little tiny sequences and you use a computer algorithm to figure out where they overlay.
And so you do this enough times and it sequences enough pieces that the computer can then piece them all together like a jigsaw.
It's kind of like if you take a camera and you, instead of taking a panorama camera, mm-hmm. you know, you take a regular 35mm camera and you just take a shot after shot after shot, just moving around randomly, mm-hmm. okay? And you scan all those in, and you use a computer program to put all those pictures together to make one big picture.
It's a beautiful analogy since I'm a photographer.
I thought that might help.
But yeah, okay, so as long as you have just enough overlap on any side, it can figure out what goes next to what and by there, rather than a jigsaw piece
right.
and back together, it's a constructivist,
exactly.
like a ratchet.
Yeah.
It allows you to
yeah.
ratchet it up.
Yeah. And since you can get a computer to do this for you, it's so much faster because
right.
before, you know, it was just basically, you know, it was people saying, okay, well, we've got from here to here. Okay, now let's go one step further.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go one
oh,
step
God,
further.
You get thousands of grad students
so
pouring
it was
over going, pages.
Yeah,
of
and it was just so much. It was so much work, and it was slated to take. I can't remember exactly what the numbers are.
In Demon Haunted World, he says it's supposed to wrap in 2012. I think.
Yeah,
it was
gonna be like 20 years, I think. And he got it done in like 7. Like they got done way ahead of schedule. They got
yeah.
done before the millennium. And you know, so it was incredible. And so I mean, this is the gold standard technique now. They do this with all these different genomes, and they're adding more genomes all the time, and not just more genomes, but they're sort of, you know, revising the genomes, and I think they're on their 5th revision of the human genome. I mean, that's
really
5 times they've, you know, been able to go through and correct any mistakes. So it's you know,
glorious error checking protocol working that fast.
Yeah. And what's more is well, here's the thing about something like the Human Genome Project. It's really kind of worthless. And the reason I say that is because of mutations. And not just random mutations, but mutations that are sort of built into who we are. Mutations that are...
I thought that mutations, by definition, were either caused by radiation or copy errors or biochemical problems.
They are. And usually it's just something. Yeah, usually it's just something random that happens, and you either never notice it or it gets filtered out of the genome. But sometimes they stick around, and sometimes they're even like physiologically relevant. And somewhere between irrelevance and relevance, they become polymorphisms.
Which is where you get your major phenotypic differences that don't
right.
affect basic anatomy, things like skin color or patterning on snakes and that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. And the thing is that there are a lot of polymorphisms. And they really are... you know, things like skin color, you know, maybe not so relevant, but things like, well, one of my favorite genes, apolipoprotein E, can be very relevant in terms of human disease.
What is
and,
it?
Well, apolipoprotein E is my background, my graduate background is in lipid metabolism, and the protein that we studied was apolipoprotein E. It's a protein that participates in lipid metabolism. It the way that lipids get around, because obviously, I mean, you think about it, your blood is made of water, fat is oil, basically. Oil and water don't mix, so there's got to be some way for the fat to get carried around in your blood. And the way this happens is it sort of forms like a bubble, you know, like when you're using your Dawn dish soap and you see the little bubbles of fat in the, you know.
Right.
Those are called like little fat vesicles, and something very similar happens in your blood, but instead of soap, it's proteins that sort of form this interface between the fat and your blood. And these proteins are called lipoproteins, or apolipoproteins, and the complex that they form is called a lipoprotein. This is a combination of lipid, which is fat and cholesterol, and these proteins.
Now, this protein is what makes the difference between the high-density and the low-density lipids, right?
No, actually.
Okay.
The difference, well, ApoE isn't, but one of the other apolipoproteins is.
Okay.
The apolipoprotein that's associated with the low-density lipoproteins is ApoB, and the one that's associated with the high-density lipoproteins is apolipoprotein A1.
Okay, so...
So what these proteins do is sort of mediate the transport of these lipids throughout your body, because they obviously, when you eat fat, it goes into your stomach, into your gut, and it's absorbed through your intestine. And it actually goes straight from your intestine to your lymph, and it goes from your lymph to your blood, and it ends up getting – it basically floats around your body for a little bit, but it all ends up in your liver, and it gets repackaged and sent back out to your body as various other lipoproteins. And ApoE is one of these proteins that's associated with the lipoprotein metabolism at one point in the metabolism, near the beginning. It's associated primarily with what are called VLDL particles. And these are particles that are actually packaged in the liver and sent out to the body to deliver fat. Basically, they're full of triglycerides, which are fat.
Right. VLDL is very low-density lipids?
Very low. Yeah, okay. So that's right. And it's mostly fat and some cholesterol. And the ApoE that's attached to these particles acts as a ligand for various receptors, such as the LDL receptor and the LDL receptor-related protein. And it does a couple of other really cool things also. The problem is that there's three different polymorphisms of this protein, ApoE. They're called ApoE2, ApoE3, and ApoE4. And don't ask me what happened to ApoE1. I don't know.
Fell out of the genome at some point.
It's disappeared into the annals of lipid metabolism for some reason. I don't know why. No, it's kind of interesting. The three isoforms they're called, or the polymorphism of this protein, really only has very, very slight difference. There's two different positions, two different amino acid positions, the position 112 and 158. And in E2, you have the amino acid cysteine at both positions. For ApoE4, you have arginine at both positions. And for E3, you have cysteine at 112 and arginine at 158. So very, very small differences, but a big change in the way it functions. The ApoE2 isoform, actually it's in a very small percentage of the people that have the ApoE2 isoform, they develop what's called type 3 hypercholesterolemia, because the ApoE2 does not interact with the receptor, either the LDL receptor or the LRP receptor. And so these lipoproteins, since they can't bind to the receptor, and the receptor is what mediates the transfusion of the fat into the cells, these particles just float around constantly, and they stay in the serum, and they end up causing...
Become plaque and
atherosclerosis. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Or xanthomas or whatever. And with E3, they don't have this problem. With E4, actually, they have a similar problem. It's a little complicated, but E4 has something else that's interesting. It is the only genetic determinant that we know of that has a correlation with Alzheimer's disease.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
We don't know.
We don't know. Okay.
We don't even know. Honestly, we don't even know what causes Alzheimer's disease. We know...
It's functionally very similar to Down syndrome from what I've seen from MRI scans of the degeneration.
Yeah, and it's very similar to, yeah, it's basically a neurodegenerative disease. It's similar to mad cow disease or Creutzfeldt-Jakob. You just get dead neurons, and, you know, dead neurons equals loss of function.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is we don't really know why they're dying. The thing is, we know that there are two phenomena that we see in brains of Alzheimer's patients. We see these amyloid plaques, which are these deposits of amyloid B protein, amyloid beta. And we also see these neurofibrillary tangles, which are composed primarily of hyperphosphorylated tau, which is a protein that's sort of associated with a microtubules inside these neurons. The problem is we don't know whether one causes the other, whether they're related at all, or whether
they're both effects of a different cause,
or whether they're both there because the neurons just happen to be dying, and, you know, this is just a secondary or dependent effect on the neurons dying.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's sort of the thing that doesn't get talked about much. I mean, everybody's really excited anytime you can say, well, I think we've figured out, you know, how to prevent these neurofibrillary tangles from forming. It's like, well, yeah, does it even matter? You know, it's still a big question. But anyway, so that was an example of, you know, polymorphism being really important, you know, as opposed to like hair color or eye color or something like that.
Right. Now, but you were using those to get at why the Human Genome Project is essentially useless. Wouldn't it be useful to have an ongoing history of the mutation of the species?
Yes, it would, and that's what they're doing now.
Okay.
They're actually putting together these individual polymorphism sites are called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs.
So, and, single nucleotide, that means there's only one base pair?
Yeah, just one. Like in ApoE, there's the one base pair that changes the cysteine to an arginine. Right. So what they're doing now is creating a SNP database, which is incredibly, you know, important, because we're able to sort of zero in and we're able to look at the different phenotypes of the different SNPs and figure out, well, what makes this gene relevant? Because that's basically, in molecular genetics, that's how you figure out how a gene works. You basically, you know, change little pieces of it,
right,
and see, well, what does it make this do, or what does it make, you know, what does it do now, or what does it do after I've changed this to that?
Right, what they did in all the famous fruit fly experiments in the 70s.
Yeah, and they're still doing. I mean, that's basically how, except we, they still use fruit flies, but we use mice also, because mouse genetics is a little bit closer to human, and it's not too hard to do, although I'm doing one right now, and it's no picnic, let me tell you. But anyway, so they're putting together a SNP database, which is really cool, because we'll be able to look at, because the SNPs are really what make the genome a really dynamic thing, because it's not just, there is no such thing as the human genome.
Right. If it was, we'd all be clones.
Right, exactly. And if the human genome was the human genome, we would all be Craig Venter, because here's a little secret. Most of the DNA that was submitted for the Human Genome Project was Craig Venter's. It was supposed to be a pretty, because they knew about, I mean, they were aware of SNPs, and they knew that there's going to be a huge amount of variability.
Mm-hmm.
And so the original project, the project that was put together by the government, recommended that they get submissions of DNA from people from all over the globe. Mm-hmm. You know, so they had a good variety.
Yeah.
And, turns out that the submission from Tiger and Solera, which was Craig Venter's company, was exclusively his DNA.
Oh, I love
which is kind of, whatever. But he was able to diagnose a genetic disease that he had. So
really?
It worked out pretty well for him.
Oh,
he had some sort of a heart condition that he didn't know about. So he's feeling fine, and he is, I think he's somewhat retired. I think he's moved on from Solera now even, and he's got a yacht. He's richer beyond belief now. He's got a yacht that it's got sequencing machines, genetics laboratory, and he floats around, I think he was in the Mediterranean last. And he basically sails around and drops anchor once a day and scoops up muck from the bottom of the seafloor and sequences any DNA he finds. And he has cataloged several thousand new species of bacteria and other types of organisms that that nobody has ever discovered before, because there's all kinds of stuff at the bottom of the ocean. And he's having the time of his life. It's not a bad way to make your living, I have to say.
No, not at all.
But so there's going to be a lot of cool stuff coming from his work for years to come, which is good. But yeah, but even the SNP database, it's really not quite all the way there.
I would imagine it's going to take a long time to.
Well, even when it's even when it's finished, it's, you know, it's really not not quite up to the practical snuff that you'd really like to see. Well, there's what I think is going to be the biggest thing since, oh, I don't know, penicillin, is going to be something that's called pharmacogenomics. And this is, you know, a very basic problem. Everybody knows about it, but nobody really, everybody just kind of accepts it. You go to the doctor, you've got something, I don't know, yellow fever, let's say.
Okay.
I don't know what. And he gives you a prescription, and you go to the drugstore, and you take this pill, and you read the label, and it says, you know, something about all the different side effects. Well, people just accept that side effects are a, you know, a fact of life.
But if you can tailor the drug to the particular gene sequence and biochemical environment, you don't get side effects.
Exactly. Because for the most, I mean, most of these side effects are due to, you know, a SNP in just sort of the wrong place. You've got one particular SNP that makes you metabolize the drug a certain way that causes a different byproduct that makes you, I don't know, nauseous or, you know, gives you diarrhea or something unpleasant. Well, wouldn't it be great if you could go into the doctor's office and he could, you know, upon diagnosing you, he could go to a computer and tap in your name and see sort of a chart based on your own personal genome and the SNPs that you have in your genome, which drugs you will not tolerate and which drugs you will tolerate.
Very handy. I mean, privacy nightmare, but medically incredible.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously.
That's the case with any new technology.
Right. But, I mean, it's really, I mean, you could get that to happen even under the HIPAA guidelines that we have now.
Right.
I mean, it's really no different from your medical record. I mean, if they treat it the same as your medical records. But, I mean, imagine no side effects for anyone. I mean, that's just incredible.
And at a certain level of sophistication, that's going to blur the line, too, between pharmacology and gene therapy.
Well, yeah, it very well could. But that's going to be huge. And then I would say in the next, oh, I don't know, maybe 20 years, we might have the computing power to actually pull something like that off.
Very nice.
It's just a question of, I think the question is sequencing power. Because we've got, we can sequence dedicated facility. You could sequence a genome in about 2 weeks, I would say.
Very nice.
So
it's already quite a ways ahead of where it was a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah. And it just keeps on getting better and better and better and better and better. I mean, I can sequence pretty much anything for about $5 a sequence now, given the technology that we have. So, but that's only about 1 KB at a time. So you've got to go, you know, pretty far. So,
how about fixing actual faulty SNPs that people have in their DNA? Like, I've
heard
about embedding things in viruses and sending them into the body to actually fix metabolic errors and things like that.
Theoretically, that's entirely possible. We have the technology now to do that. The problem is, the problem is one of ethics, not one of science.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah, there's one of the, well, okay, there's a couple of different ways you can do it. You can do it sort of transiently, or you can do it permanently. You can give a run-of-the-mill virus, like an adenovirus or something like that, where it infects cells. We use these in mice all the time. You get this virus, and you basically just go in and tweak the DNA, tweak the genome of the virus, and make it so it can't actually replicate, but it can infect.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a vector for whatever DNA that you want to put in there that is basically it's non-toxic.
Right.
It's going to infect. You're going to inject it. It's going to infect whatever cells it comes in contact with, but it's not going to do any damage because it can't replicate. So it's going to go into the cell. It's going to transcribe the DNA, but you're not actually going to have a viral infection because it can't reproduce itself. And so the effects of the virus will last basically as long as the cell lasts. So when the cell dies, the virus dies with it.
It doesn't get passed on as the cell duplicates?
No, because it's not inserted into the genome.
Oh, okay.
So it's
Is there any way to insert it into the genome?
Yes, there is, using a retrovirus, a different type of virus. The same type of virus that's used by HIV.
Okay, real quick, because I'm actually not clear on what it is, so I imagine no one listening is going to be...
Oh, sorry.
What is the basic functional difference between a virus and a retrovirus, then?
Right, well, there's DNA viruses, which are just balls of protein that are filled with DNA, and the balls of protein get sucked into cells, and the protein falls apart, the DNA gets exposed to the machinery, replicative machinery inside the cell, and the DNA gets transcribed. Retroviruses carry their genomic information as RNA instead of DNA.
Okay.
And to get it to transcribe,
they have to get it into the duplication machinery of the cell itself rather than just using the duplication machinery.
Right. They use a couple different enzymes, a reverse transcriptase and an integrase.
The reverse
transcriptase turns the RNA into DNA, and the integrase takes the DNA and it sort of sticks it into the host genome.
Okay.
And from then it's transcribed with, depending on where it's inserted, it is transcribed whenever the host's DNA is transcribed. And any time that cell replicates, is replicated along with it, which is why you can never be cured of HIV. Because once the virus has inserted itself into the genome of the cell, as long as you're alive, basically, it's going to be
there. You're a carrier even if you're not symptomatic or grossly infected with a heavy load.
Right. And assuming you're able to actually target that insertion to some place that was completely innocuous, it wouldn't be so bad of a thing. The problem is that these insertions can happen in places that you really don't want them to happen. They can happen in the middle of genes that are crucial for regulating the cell cycle.
Mm. And we don't yet have the ability to target them to a particular insertion point.
Unfortunately not. They're still pretty random, and so when that happens, let's say if you deactivate an enzyme that shuts down the cell cycle, you get cancer.
Right.
So one of the problems with the retrovirus therapies is that you get a pretty high incidence of like lymphoma and other types of cancers.
And that would be the reason why, for example, viruses like HPV actually induce cancer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd often wondered about that.
And even with the DNA viruses, in my graduate work, I was working with some viral therapies in mice. There was actually a guy, he was doing some clinical trials with humans, getting transient transfection using an adenovirus. It was an experimental protocol. I think all the patients were terminal. I don't remember what disease, but even despite that, one of the patients, I think it was a teenage boy, got an overdose of the virus and died.
Mm.
And there's a huge backlash at that point, and they pretty much shut down
any retroviral therapy experiment.
No, this wasn't even retrovirus. It was just a regular adenovirus.
Oh, wow.
So he died from it, and so so everybody sort of was like, well, we'll have to step back and rethink this whole gene therapy thing with virus. But there's other ways to do it, too. You can use liposomes, which are little sort of like mini cells. They're not actually a cell, but they're made out of the same membrane that a cell's made of. And you can just sort of fill them up with DNA and inject them in somebody. And the idea is when they come in contact with the cell, because they're made of the same type of membrane, they just get sort of fused into the cell. and the DNA gets in there and starts transcribing. And it works pretty well if you're trying to introduce DNA into cells and things like that, but I don't think it works terribly well clinically yet. Yeah, unfortunately, gene therapy really hasn't progressed like a lot of people thought it would.
Do you see a future in it, or are you beginning to suspect that it's a dead end?
Well, never say never. I mean, I think people are going to keep plugging away at it, and eventually they'll figure out, you know, what the pitfalls are, and they'll get, you know, better and more efficient at it. And I think it eventually will become a viable therapy, just not quite yet.
Do you think it's going to have to be nanotech that gives us the precision to be able to do it?
Quite possibly. But yeah, it might take a huge leap forward in like material science with nanotechnology for us to be able to do something like that. Honestly, I think it'd be more likely that we get an actual human clone before we start tinkering around with individual genes.
When you were talking about the difference between viruses and retroviruses, you mentioned HIV as a retrovirus.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I've run into over and over and over again recently, and that Deb and I have been bitching to each other about for the last few weeks, is, for lack of a better term, AIDS skepticism.
Yeah, I've run into that too.
growing up in and around San Francisco and watching the scientific consensus develop right where everyone's dying from the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm all for skepticism, but I just can't wrap my brain around these people.
Sure. There's a lot of them, and there's an article posted on LouRockwell.com. I mean, I'm not a degree checker or, you know,
yeah,
anything like
right.
that.
She was a mathematical epidemiologist
Yeah, she was a mathematical epidemiologist, and she's like, well, but just the numbers aren't right. Who cares if the numbers aren't right? We've got the virus.
Yeah, okay,
I mean,
that's one of
the
charges she made in that article, was that we hadn't.
Yeah, we have.
What numbers is she talking about that aren't right?
She said the virulence is such that the contagion numbers should have spread it into the general population rather than keeping it as it has been to the gay, bisexual, and heavily drug use communities now 20 years after it was first posited.
But it's not. I mean,
it depends on what country you live in.
Yeah. I mean, look at Africa. Mm-hmm. Of course, they'll say, well, the main argument from the HIV myth people is that AIDS is caused by
a multiple chemical sensitivity, or I've heard benzene poisoning thrown around a lot.
Exposure to multiple DNA doses from different sexual partners.
You're kidding. I haven't heard that one.
I've heard that you actually, the idea is that because the colon is so much more absorbent, and it's, you actually get more exposure to antigens, foreign antigens from semen, and so the idea is that gay men have it's basically just a sort of an immune response, an autoimmune response, and they're actually just allergic to semen, and it manifests.
Oh my
as AIDS.
God! You two are both trained in the medical profession and sciences. I'm not, and even I know that's bullshit.
Yeah, the more common one is that it's just like a not necessarily immoral lifestyle, but a bad lifestyle,
right,
like
a
living
destructive one,
you
like,
know, or just being sort of malnourished. You know, like that's the common rejoinder to the Africa thing is like, well, but those people don't get enough to eat, and
there's a lot of pollution,
disease, and it's like, you don't get Kaposi sarcoma because you're not eating. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It doesn't happen.
There's a lot of poor people in rural America that don't get enough to eat or don't eat the right nutritious foods.
True,
and
true.
Yeah. You're not seeing the same epidemiology here.
Yeah. So it's, this type of skepticism is typical. It's not just confined to HIV either. There's lots of things. You're always going to find little pockets.
Holocaust deniers.
Oh, yeah, there's
there's flat Earth believers out there still. There's a flat Earth society. there's back in medicine, there are cholesterol mythers. There are people that believe that cholesterol does not cause heart disease. They, you know, just flat out deny. They say, well, cholesterol is healthy. I mean, cholesterol is in every single cell of your body. It's necessary for membranes.
Invariably, you know, that kind of popular superstition seems to draw support from people who are attempting to nuance an inadequate public understanding, and then paranoid people seem to grab onto it and go, wait, he said.
Right, right. And part of the reason why these types of myths are so difficult to just sort of stamp out is the fact that a lot of science is really non-intuitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about it, like, I mean, not just anything as sophisticated as, say, you know, cholesterol metabolism. Let's take the sun.
Right.
Okay. Everybody knows that the Earth revolves around the sun. But how non-intuitive is that? You go out and you look at the horizon and you see the sun rise, go up, and set. I mean, if you took anybody who didn't know, you know, just the science behind it, or Galileo or anything like that, and you said, look, you see the sun? What's the sun doing? Oh, it's going around the Earth. I mean, that's just intuition. Mm-hmm. Like, you just look at it. It's like common sense. Of course, you see the sun come up, you see it go down. Obviously, the sun goes around the Earth. Yep. No, it's not that at all. It's non-intuitive, but it's true.
And it took...
You get in your car and you drive, and the land is flat, and you keep driving, and the land keeps being flat. You don't see any curvature to it.
Right.
So, hey,
and it took,
the Earth is flat.
It took Brahe and Kepler, what was it, 65, 70 years between them to work out the math?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's the main reason why these types of myths still... hang around.
And people are trying to sell something. Yeah. A lot of these people, especially in the medical field, they're into some sort of alternative, quote unquote, treatment, herbs, vitamins.
You're talking about like the HIV myth guys?
Right. Things like that. Right. There's some kind of strange therapy they're trying to sell that.
Yeah. I've never seen that connection. I've just seen the skepticism side. But there's tons of pseudoscience out there too. Mm-hmm. There's
if you go to quackwatch.com,
wonderful
site, just endless. Yeah.
And the real tragedy of it is that I mean I can't tell you the number of, for example, creationists that I've seen. What's his name that wrote Evolution: A Theory in Crisis, who was pimping Gould's criticism of the field as a disproof of the field.
Oh, I don't recall.
That was I can't remember what his name was. Anyway, it was the major popular precursor to Darwin's Black Box. It was written in 85.
Okay.
But he took Gould's attempt to bring contingent historical insight into evolution as evidence that we were dealing with an ad hoc hypothesis. Yeah, but people bought it.
It's really hard for me to get into that frame of mind. When I was a little kid, I came from a very religious background. I can remember one time... it was right after church, and I was, every little kid loves dinosaurs, and they, you know, read all the dinosaur books, and I absolutely loved it, and I was big into it, and I don't know what got me thinking about this. It must have been one of the Sunday school classes. We were, our Sunday school class was pretty heavy on the doctrine, I guess. We were at a small Reformed Calvinist church,
fun.
and the... And it was the Sunday school was directed by this very serious and somber British guy. So it was.
So he had the accent to give him authority too.
There's
this moral authority for Americans that seems to come with a British accent.
Yeah, I guess. But he must have been laying it on pretty thick that day. And I can remember walking out afterwards to the car, and I was thinking, and I was like, and. It just sort of occurred to me, it was like, well, you know, if Christianity is true, then creation is true. But I got all these books at home that show pictures of dinosaurs, and they talk about dinosaur fossils and people digging them up. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like my little brain was trying to work the two out somehow. And I said to my dad, I said, you know, I wonder if somebody hid those bones down there for people to find, and they're not really real.
Hmm.
Looking back, it's kind of hard for me to believe that I actually made that connection, but I did. And my dad just looked at me, and he didn't sit me down and explain everything, but he basically looked at me and said, no, that's not the case. They're real. Mm-hmm. But he didn't really go any farther than that, which is kind of unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Because, although on the other hand, it left me to sort of puzzle out myself, which I'm kind of glad about.
Yeah, I grew up in a non-denominational Christian school. They laid it on thick all the time. And my father, a conservative theology professor, finally took to sitting me down forcibly after school in front of Nova specials.
Yeah, that's just so frightening. And you know, part of that is the reason why I do the podcast. It's because even among people that don't really take religion seriously at all, they don't really know what evolution's all about. You know, they just don't know. I mean, and I don't think it's really taught very well. There's a guy who does another podcast, the Big Bang and Creationism podcast, Rob Lippens, and he's a senior in high school now. I was talking with him and asking him, you know, how much do you actually learn about creationism? He's like, well, you know, enough, I guess. I said, but do you, I mean, is it actually like a topic of conversation? Because it never was for me when I was in high school. And maybe it's just because I was at a pretty white bread suburban school that pretty much everybody was a Christian there. And
so it was assumed rather than...
I guess it was. I mean, the biology classes there were pretty poor. They didn't really get very sophisticated at all. But I mean, it's just like just nothing. And of course, eventually in college, we got into pretty heavily. I was a biology major, but just high school. I mean, most people, I mean, unless you're going into biology or something related, that you don't even get into that in college. And I don't think the public high schools are doing a very good job. Mm-hmm. I think actually the ones that are starting to do the creation, the co-curriculum, the creation evolution curriculum, I'm like, well, at least they are teaching evolution, which is more than I could say of my high school.
Yeah, there is that.
But, so there's just a lot of misconceptions out there. And so I guess that's why I enjoy doing the podcast so much.
The very notion of gaps in the theory is a semantic non sequitur. Gaps in the theory. The theory doesn't have gaps. It might have contravening evidence. It might have problems, or it might have neither. But you don't have gaps in a theory. It's lexically nonsensical.
Yeah, and even if it were the case, the same argument could be made for any other theory.
Of course.
We would have gaps in the gravitational theory. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that if you drop an apple, it will not fall to
the
ground?
Just because we don't understand why gravity works doesn't mean that the rocks stop falling.
It doesn't work. Yeah, exactly.
Deb, do you have anything to pick his brain about? I've kind of run to the end of everything I was storing in my brain.
Well, I consider myself fortunate. I think I may have understood about 12% of this. Then I feel like I should be paying tuition or something. It's been, the parts that I've been able to grasp have been very interesting. I really need to start listening to your podcast.
I guess maybe I should give some coordinates for that then.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, please.
The podcast is Evolution 101. It can be found on iTunes. It is currently the number one evolution-themed podcast on iTunes.
Congratulations.
Although it is also the only evolution-themed podcast on iTunes.
I was waiting for that.
The website for the show is at my website. It's www.drzach.net/evolution101. Archives can also be found at the Free Thought Media website, freethoughtmedia.com/evolution101.ftm. And I also maintain a blog where I keep transcripts of the podcasts at evolution-101.blogspot.com. And anybody can feel free to email me anytime they like at zach@drzach.net. There's also a little feedback form on the website.
Excellent. So. What books or TV series or anything would you recommend to someone to whom religion is or isn't important who wants to wrap their mind around at least the basics of what goes on in evolutionary biology?
I would say Finding Darwin's God. I think that's a really great popular explanation. It's written for the layperson. I mean, it's not like The Selfish Gene is great, and I understood it, but I don't know how accessible it is to everybody else, although I really love Dawkins' writing style. All of his books are great. I just finished The Ancestor's Tale, and it was so...
Oh, isn't that gorgeous?
Oh, it's so wonderful. Let's see, what else is on my bookshelf that I could recommend? If you can stomach it, it's really great to read Darwin. I have to say. Really? For no other reason than Darwin sort of gets mischaracterized a lot. You know, I mean, he sort of gets taken advantage of, and, you know, it's, I guess it's only fair because he's been dead for
forever. It seems to me he gets painted with the same brush that Nietzsche does. People who have heard third hand of his ideas and that Hitler liked them tend to throw them both in the same box.
Yeah.
And neither of them would have approved.
Yeah. Well, Hitler was also pro-religion, so, you know, I guess there's that. But anyway, if you can read Darwin, if you, I mean, if you can stomach that, I think it's really interesting to read him, is that Darwin is his own worst critic. I mean, it seems like it seems like after every page, he sort of stops and says, well, this is what, you know, this is what the evidence is telling me, but I might be wrong. There might be other explanations for this.
And here are some ways to disprove
it. Yeah. Well, there may be, but at the same time, I'm compelled by the evidence to draw these conclusions, which is what any good scientist should do. I mean, any good scientist, when they're you know, writing up their data, should try to be as critical as possible. And other scientists should be as critical as possible, too. I mean, that's part of the whole process. There really is a pretty high standard. And, you know, it's just really great to read Darwin and hear him coming down on himself and saying, you know, just pointing out all the flaws in his own arguments. And yet, after pointing out all the flaws, still saying, well, even despite all these potential flaws, I really do think it is the best conclusion that we have from this evidence. So if you can stomach it, I do recommend it.
Excellent. Darwin's Dangerous Idea, what do you think about that one?
I haven't actually read that.
Oh, okay.
That's who wrote that?
Yeah, that was Dennett. I really enjoyed it, but I hesitate often to recommend it to people because several people I know have read it and found it to be hopelessly nihilistic. Mm-hmm. I didn't find that in there, but...
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Another one that I read recently was Unintelligent Design by Mark Parakh.
Nice title.
It's not so much about evolution. It basically covers the main guys in the intelligent design camp and sort of tears their argument to pieces, especially Bill Dembski.
Nice.
He's got a pretty good head for numbers, which I don't have, and that's the bulk of Dembski's arguments.
Yeah, of all of the ID people, Dembski's the only one who's impressed me, and most of that's because I don't have a head for numbers, so it'd be nice to read
it. Well, it's really interesting to go through because this guy does, and he shows pretty clearly where, at least according to the book, Dembski just sort of throws up numbers out of nowhere, and he's like, and you know, in the book,
massive rectal extraction operation.
Yeah, he goes through and he says, you know, he actually goes through and looks at these formulas one by one, which I'm sure nobody else who actually reads Dembski's work does. They see the numbers, their eyes glaze over, and they
trust that what he's saying corresponds.
They go to the
with
conclusion.
The proofs.
So anyway, I thought it was interesting to go through that because, like, the whole information theory aspect of the intelligent design argument is really, really bogus. And nobody who doesn't have an engineering degree understands information theory. But from what I do understand, it's completely bogus.
Oh, also, I don't know. Have you read the Dover trial transcripts yet?
I've read some of them. Yeah, I've read some of them.
Yeah, for anyone listening, if you care about this issue and you haven't read them, they're a good primer on the history of evolution, the history of intelligent design, the battle between them, and the judge's decision is a work of glorious, glorious prose.
Mm-hmm.
You can find them all online at aclupa.org. They've got a special section set aside for it.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody's going to come along and edit all that together and make a nice book out of that, so
that'll be wonderful.
What I'm hoping for anyway.
Yeah. I think that's about all I got. All
right.
Deb, you got anything else?
Oh, no. like I said, I'm a little out of my element here. It's a little bit more technical than what I'm used to trying to understand, but that's good. I do need to stretch my brain a bit, so I appreciate this very much. It's been wonderful. So thank you, Zach.
No problem.
Well, thanks a lot, Zach. It's been great.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Glad to talk to you, Dan and Deb.
See you later.
See you.
I was trying to think in the interim if I knew I'd listened to an Evolution 101 show with Dr. Pigliucci, but I was trying to think if I ever listened to one with Zach, and I don't think I did. But, man, what a cool guy.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy.
Yeah. I really did. I didn't say much because I just was like, I'm completely out of my element here, you know? I just don't have the background to understand all this.
Yeah, I wouldn't if I weren't a compulsive bookworm. Zach Moore, ladies and gentlemen, and now here's the Reprobates News.
Hello, this is Hera Flea with the Reprobates News. Exciting developments in science news. Last week, geneticists at the Genetics Research Lab in Pescadero successfully isolated the gay gene, or in actuality, genes. Three separate gene sequences were found to act on gender identity and sexual attraction, producing the range of sexual orientation observed by Dr. Kinsey. Homosexual rights activists are thrilled at the news. One unnamed member of GLAAD said, "We've been saying it's nature, not nurture, for years, and we were right. It's time to stop discriminating against something that is just as much a choice as red hair or astigmatism." Pro-family groups have been surprisingly quiet about this announcement, stating only that this does not change God's mind on morality. Fred Phelps, however, has organized a protest at the Genetics Research Lab, calling for God's people to destroy, quote, "this lying den of immorality that spits upon God's law." In political news, several hardline pro-life groups have shifted their stated goals to no abortion, with exceptions allowed in cases of the life of the mother, rape or incest, and certain genetic conditions which would inhibit a child's quality of life. They refused to specify what genetic conditions should apply, stating that this should be determined by the mother, her doctor, and her priest or minister. That's it for the Reprobates News. This is Hera Flea signing off. Until next time.
Next week, we have no scheduled guest, but we'll be talking about one of our personal pet peeves, overparenting.
I came up with this idea based on several articles that I read recently about incidents that happened on MySpace. For those of you who are aware of that, that's one of the more common web spaces for young people to put up little profiles of themselves with pictures and information.
And indeed for free thought media hosts.
Right, yes, us too. And yeah, supposedly there's sexual predators and or, you know, police detectives posing as them out there. Mm-hmm. I've also read articles recently on parents who are way too involved in their child's college educations to the point where there are daily or more frequent phone calls. The parents call the professors and harass them if the child gets a poor grade. And any little trivial matter, the parent has to get involved. So, of course, the child never has a chance to mature by fighting his or her own battles mm-hmm. the way he should be. And this extends even into the job market, where the child is done with college, has his or her degree, goes out into the job market, interviews for a job, and then you have mom or dad calling up the person who interviewed the child for the job and saying, "Hey, how about it?"
Yeah, I have a friend whose parents did that recently, completely ruined his chances of getting a union job anywhere in the Bay Area.
And that is as it should be. This article I read, actually, it was more like the interviewers were knuckling under to the parents, and I was just like, what? The kid should be DQ'd from that job just based on that alone.
You know, humans, at the latest, wean at about 5 years old.
Exactly.
The fact that these adults, and by adults, I mean 16 to 23 years old.
Right.
These adult human beings capable of reproducing, most of them legally eligible to vote, are still sucking on mom's tits.
That is pathetic.
Terrible.
That is pathetic. The apron strings are reaching all the way across the country, or the umbilical cord. I think it's still the umbilical cord, actually.
Yeah, it really is. Jeez. Yeah, can't be good for the children's mental health. It certainly isn't good for our culture's health. Have you noticed how much grander and more authoritarian our politicians have been getting over the last 15
Definitely.
Years?
Yeah, adults handle their own problems unless they're overwhelming. And by overwhelming, I don't mean, oh, golly, I'm really nervous about this job interview. It would really be nice if Dad could call up the recruiter and put in a good
overwhelming
word.
Means my ex-boyfriend broke into my house. I had to shoot him, and then the forensics team wouldn't clean it up. So I'm having kind of a bad day having to scrape his brains off
exactly.
the wall. That's overwhelming.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, if you want to find out what we really think about this topic, rather than just hearing this rather milquetoast version of it we're giving you here, Tune in next week, which we're going to try to schedule for the same time slot, but there's enough hosts at Freethought Media now that we're having to compete.
That's great. I love it.
We're going to try... Oh, yeah, it is. Absolutely. We're going to try to schedule for the same time slot, and until then, this is Dan the Demented.
And Deviant Dub.
Saying, get your mind out of the sewer. We want to be alone.